Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead of the game. Coming up on the program today, a 700 million rand talk fest, concern growing over government's costly national dialogue plan. The South African divorce shake-up, big changes to who gets what. Teens and tech, how not to mess up online, and mixed use is fast taking over the Cape Town CBD. It's Friday, the 20th of June. Let's start with this, and government's recently announced 700 million rand national dialogue has ignited something of a public backlash over perceived wasteful spending amid growing economic hardship. Some critics arguing that politicians should be addressing basics like job creation and service delivery and not funding a big talk shop. As Chief Executive Officer of the Small Business Institute, John Dludlu is uniquely positioned, I think, to address both the economic and SME impact of this initiative, and he joins me at the top of the program. John, a very warm welcome, and in your opinion then, does this idea have any merit?
Jeremy, thank you very much, and good afternoon. The idea has merit. I'm supporting the idea. It's long overdue. Secondly, I am intending to actively participate in it. I have attended quite a few meetings. So I've been part of the idea for a few months. What I don't believe in is that I don't think we are all sharing the same objective about the idea. By us all, I mean the foundations on the one hand, civil society, the churches, and then, of course, the elephant in the room, which is government. I don't think we're on the same slate about what the dialogue has to achieve.
So let's get to the objectives in just a moment, but there is the argument about why prioritizing dialogue when government could rather provide interest relief grants or training for thousands of SMEs. Is this something that your constituency broadly, do you think, would welcome and prioritize?
I think our constituency would broadly share the fact that the country is drifting. The country has got no vision anymore. We've had the ANC, I think, has done what it could do, but it's run out of ideas now. And the GNU, after 1 year, has participated in practically, I think, the crisis that was created by the ANC. I don't think the country is about to do course correction. So our constituency, the ecosystem of the SME and cooperatives, I think would welcome something that jumpstart the economy. It will start with a conversation. The Irish have done it. We've done it before. We can still do it again.
So let's talk, John, about those objectives and the old cliche, you can't manage something unless you can measure it. So are there specific KPIs you think that should be in place to evaluate whether this concept generates tangible business growth and employment rather than just the feel-good rhetoric that, to be honest, we're starting to hear already?
Jeremy, I think a good starting point would be to not come with new plans. The inflection point of where we are now has come about because of the loss of Nationwood. I don't think we share a common nationhood as South Africans. We have an economic plan. It's called the National Development Plan, but it's not under implementation. So I wouldn't say let's do something new, certainly not about the economy. We've got structural reforms that are going on now in the electricity, in the network industries. Let us just implement this. What is the dialogue supposed to do? The problem statement is about what we want to see in the next 50 years about the country. But I wouldn't pause anything that we're doing now. I'll just say, let's give impetus to what we're doing now.
John, would it not be more useful rather to focus more on delivering the objectives of that national development plan instead of talking about it, though?
The National Development Plan is not implemented. Actually, I don't know why we call it a plan, because a plan has got day one. What happens on day one? What happens on the last day? How do you measure success? We have a vision statement, Vision 2030, but it doesn't have a project plan how to get there. That's what we are requiring now. We don't have to reimagine anything other than to talk about who we want to be as South Africans. I think we all sleepwalked into these 30 years, hoping the politicians will get us where we want to be. They haven't. They've failed us. So it's time for dialogue.
Time for dialogue, John, but it's expensive dialogue. 700 million rand as an initial cost. That figure could climb. Do you think it'll be worth it?
Jeremy, the figure is quite sexy. 700 million rand is quite a lot. But if it was really that figure, I would have laughed and I would have expected the Minister of Finance to talk about it. He specifically said he has not budgeted for it. So that's why I think we're playing games. I don't think we are serious about this. There are other priorities. There's G20, B20 this year, and I really don't think we're on the same page with government, the foundations, and the churches. The churches, by the way, started this dialogue long ago, and it would be a sad day if the churches are marginalized. They are very frustrated. We need to bring them to the fold.
So, John, if that's the case, then why are you supporting it?
I'm supporting it because I think it's long overdue. Jeremy, we are facing a huge explosion, a social explosion, and the makings of it are twofold. It is not having this dialogue, not containing the frustrations of South Africans, and then of course the youth unemployment. I have a youth who's not employed right now. And it gives me sleepless nights. We really have to do something about this.
Just a quick one in conclusion. If this dialogue fails to deliver measurable improvement, someone or some entity has got to be held accountable, and it's critical that accountability is enforced. Are you confident that's going to happen?
Then I think we are wasting our time if there's no accountability. The way we've framed it, the way it's been framed, certainly by the presidency and government, is to inquire into what has happened in the last 15 years. That's when I think we started drifting towards this direction. Mm-hmm. Crime and corruption and huge unemployment, poverty, inequality. So South Africans, certainly civil society is expecting, by civil society I also mean business, by the way. Those are the sectors of society that are enjoying trust levels other than government. If you look at the Elderman's trust index, government does not enjoy any trust among society. So, Jeremy, we have to hold people accountable. And we've not all been in charge in the last 15 years.
I'm going to leave it there. Chief Executive Officer of the Small Business Institute, John Dludlu, I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday.
for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's pending General Family Laws Amendment Bill seeks to overhaul the Divorce Act of 1979, the Matrimonial Property Act of 1984, as well as associated mediation laws. Now, as far as I understand it, the sweeping reform is a direct response to the Constitutional Court's October 2023 judgment, which found that spouses married out of community of property without accrual were left without any post-divorce protection, often women who supported households but had no claim to assets. Now, the proposed legislation would give courts the power to redistribute assets even when accrual is excluded or in marriages predating the accrual regime introduced in November 1984. Let's make some sense of this. I'm with a family lawyer, family attorney Bertus Preller from the firm Maurice Phillips Weissenberg. Bertus, a very warm welcome. So the major changes introduced by this amendment, just explain to me what they are and what key gaps identified by the Constitutional Court then does it seek to fill?
The biggest change is that courts will now be able to redistribute assets between spouses who are married out of community of property without the accrual. So actually, in plain language, if a couple, you know, kept their finances strictly separate due to the antenuptial contract and the marriage ends, whether by divorce or even by death, a judge can now award a fair share of one spouse's assets to the other. And this was introduced to protect spouses who supported their partner or family without owning any assets of their own. So it was then that the Constitutional Court ruled last year that it's unfair and unconstitutional that these spouses, mostly women, who were homemakers, walk away with nothing. Mm. So actually, the law is catching up to ensure fairness, and essentially we're closing a loophole in a divorce act.
So what criteria then, Bertus, will guide a judge's decision in that asset redistribution?
Well, the new powers allow a court to transfer assets from one spouse to another if a judge believes it's just and equitable. The classic example is a couple who married out of community of property without the accrual, and let's say one spouse has built a business and properties in their name, while the other spouse maybe gave up her career to raise the children or supported the business informally. Now, under the old rules, the non-owning spouse had no claim, but now they will be left to with a claim. So courts don't discriminate and would look at factors, how much they contribute to the household, or the other success contributions aren't just money. They include, for example, raising a family or running the home. And if the court's convinced, for example, that the stay-at-home spouse enabled the breadwinner to prosper, a court can say, okay, all right, let's say transfer 30% of the estate or 50% of the estate of certain assets to the other spouse.
So what impact, if any, does this have on existing antenuptial contracts, particularly those excluding accrual? Would courts be able to override such agreements?
Yes. In terms of the judgment, lawyers are already, when they issue summons now for divorces in matters where spouses were married out of community of property without the accrual, we are already now issuing claims for a redistribution of assets, notwithstanding the fact that the act hasn't been enacted yet, which will probably be in a year, in the next year or so. So the Constitutional Court already decided on that fact that you can lay claim to a redistribution claim before the amendment of the Divorce Act.
So, Bertus, in your opinion then, is this reform now pushing couples towards the accrual regime as maybe inherently fairer? And would it be better then for people to choose accrual from the outset?
You know, it's a very interesting question, because another question that pops up is whether in an ANC, you can, without the accrual, whether you can put a clause in to say, well, there's going to be no redistribution of assets, say it's a second marriage, for example. So that needs to be tested still. The problem with accrual usually in many matters that lawyers deal with is parties marry with the accrual, and then subsequent to the marriage, the husband structures a trust and build up the assets in the trust. So there's actually no accrual, and it defeats the object completely. The other issue as well is you can place a commencement value on your estate when you're married with the accrual. That then is increased by way of the consumer price index to the date of divorce, so that will be excluded, or you can exclude certain assets. So you could basically exclude so many assets that you find yourself, you know, I would say after 1 November 1984 when the law changes. So it all depends how the couple structure the estate after the marriage. So it could be to your detriment. Mm. You know, that's why I argue that we should have two systems in South Africa, one in community and then this equitable distribution that the legislator is now going to pass, because you can basically exclude assets to such an extent that there will be no accrual to a party.
Just a final one then. As a result of this, are you foreseeing potential unintended outcomes, maybe increased litigation, upfront legal costs, or even disputes over what constitutes equitable distribution?
Yeah, this is very difficult because that discretion is for the court. So I think in mediations and roundtables where you're going to try and determine, you know, a settlement or negotiate a settlement, you've got to put yourself now in the shoes of a judge to think what is equitable. And I think that's going to be a challenge for us as lawyers, because how do you determine that? And how do you agree upon that, you know?
I'm going to leave it there. Bertus Preller, thank you very much indeed. Attorney in family law at Maurice Phillips Weissenberg. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
How not to mess up online? It's a lesson that most adults, I guess, are still figuring out. Now, imagine navigating that same digital minefield as a teenager. Between deepfakes, sextortion, scams, and a fast-changing legal landscape, growing up online in South Africa these days is not just tricky or risky, it is life-altering. Selfies, sects, smartphones, a brutally honest and up-to-date digital survival guide for teens and the parents trying to protect them. Co-authored by Emma Sadler, one of South Africa's foremost digital law experts, along with Rourke Avery, a Gen Z who made mistakes so others don't have to. The book is a must-read for anyone living their life through a screen. So Emma, let's start with the reality check. I wonder if there are new mistakes that South African teens are making online today that maybe is going to lead to serious legal or reputational consequences, because that playing field has really moved, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's a very, very tricky place to navigate, the online world. And you know what's so unfair, I think, sometimes, is that we hold children to such a high standard. You know, if we think about the age of capacity when it comes to when the law starts applying to these kids, children can be arrested from 12 years old. And we're seeing that happening because of crimes committed on their phones. Children can be sued in their own capacity from 7 years old for things like defamation and infringements of privacy. We've seen a huge boom in cyberbullying and harassment, so many deepfakes, so many issues with the AI world. So I'm really proud of this book, and I hope that kids will read it, and I hope that it'll make a difference.
The problem, Emma, of course, and you've said this in the past, is the law continues to lag. So where is South African legislation most out of sync right now with this new and accelerated behavior of teenagers on screen?
Yeah, so we've had some developments, certainly since the last book, which was called Selfie, Sex and Smartphones. This one, which has just come out, is called How Not to Mess Up Online. And it covers a lot of the Cyber Crimes Act, which is a new piece of law. So what the lawmakers kind of sought to do was, where we had to go and get all different laws from different places, we've tried to kind of put all of the laws relating to the cyber world under one umbrella. So the Cyber Crimes Act came out a couple of years ago, and there are specific crimes in there around hacking, password abuse, non-consensual distribution of private sexual images, crimes around extortion, sextortion, which is the single biggest issue that I deal with on a daily basis. There are all sorts of criminal offenses in there, including, for example, sending somebody a threat, an electronic message which contains a threat of violence. I'm going to beat you up tomorrow. I'm going to kill you. A threat of damage to property. I'm going to burn your house down. just the sending of those messages is now a criminal offence. So we focus on some of the new laws, but some of the laws that we rely on, Jeremy, are laws from over 100 years ago, because we still have the common law. So we have basic common law principles, for example, who's legally responsible for user-generated content, who's responsible for the comments underneath my TikTok post, who's responsible for the comments underneath my Instagram post, who's responsible for content sent on a WhatsApp group. Is it the administrator? Is it just the poster? Is it the other people on the group? That law we rely on from a case in 1918, which still sets out the principle for how we treat user-generated content now. There are some gaps in our law, for example, AI. We've seen the EU bring out the AI law, which I think we will seek to replicate, but probably by the time it comes into law in South Africa, things will have changed so significantly and so quickly. So I think that the most important thing is to teach basic common law principles, which will hopefully hold us all in good stead as we try and navigate this pretty murky territory.
And Emma, the terrifying thing that I got out of this book was how quickly things can escalate when one bad decision can suddenly become a criminal record.
And I think that's what happens, you know. So why I said right at the beginning is I feel it's so unfair is that these kids, their brain hasn't finished developing yet. You know, we're putting it's a bit for me like giving the keys to a car to a 12-year-old and saying good luck to you without teaching them the rules of the road. You know, it requires very important decisions to be made, sometimes in the heat of the moment. And we do see children messing up. And yes, there are legal consequences, but there can also be very long-term reputational consequences. We've seen it on our own turf in South Africa, where adults have been seriously compromised personally and professionally because of content they posted online when they were 12, 13, 14-year-olds trying to be funny, maybe trying to be edgy, but getting it wrong with horrible sexist jokes or using inappropriate language, and that content coming back to haunt them. So really understanding how permanent the digital world is, how public it is, how nothing is deleted, just about every case that comes into my inbox, certainly all the cases I've been dealing with this week, have been because kids have sent content using view once technology, whether that's on Instagram, which you can do now. I can send you a video, Jeremy, for example, and set it so that you can only view it once and you're supposed to be not able to take a screen record or a screenshot. But then you use your secondary device to record it, and then that content lands up being circulated. So we're talking about the legal consequences, but we're really focusing on health as well. How do we keep our children physically safe, but also look after their mental health, because we've seen all of the huge harm that these platforms can cause our children, huge increases in depression, anxiety, addiction, and try to help our children as far as possible to survive that digital world unscathed, because growing up is tough, but growing up online is even harder.
Are there particular platforms, I wonder, that parents and teens should be most alert to right now?
The platforms that I worry about are the ones that feel the safest, I should say, because you know, what I see is that kids in primary schools getting phones as young as 8, 9, 10 years old, smartphones, and then parents saying, well, you shouldn't be on social media. So you can't have Snapchat and TikTok yet, because those, you know, the harms on those platforms are very well documented. But you can be on a WhatsApp and you can be on Discord so you can talk to your gaming mates. Let me tell you, Discord is awash with dodgy people because it's so very popular with very young children, and any place that's popular with very young children is, I'm afraid, also very popular with predators. And then I think particularly the way the South Africans use WhatsApp groups, you know, WhatsApp feels like very benign, I'm just talking to my mates, but what I'm seeing with the kids is them starting these groups that have up to 1,000, well, you can have 1,024 participants on a WhatsApp group, so it almost becomes a sort of micro social media platform in itself. Kids also updating their WhatsApp status, a lot of bullying on those WhatsApp groups. So as bizarre as it sounds, I would say my biggest fear at the moment is actually WhatsApp. I gave a talk at a primary school the other day, and this 9-year-old came to me afterwards and said, oh, but ma'am, I'm on this Add Everyone WhatsApp group. So it's just called an Add Everyone. So they just add all sorts of people they don't know. And then the dare was to send the most offensive memes they could find. I'm pretty hardened. You should see what my inbox looks like on the daily basis. I was shocked by the kind of content being circulated on that 9-year-old's phone. So I suppose it's not just, you know, these are the dangerous platforms, these are the safe platforms. It's trying to equip our children with basic digital hygiene and basic skills to keep safe as far as possible. I think a big thing that we've got to be talking about for all of us is trying to keep very young children away from these platforms. And there's been a lot of work done internationally on this. We've had the rollout of the smartphone-free childhood in South Africa, which has been, I think, an absolutely fabulous initiative. But really, you know, these skills that we talk about in the book and the laws, it's complicated. It's complicated for adults. We've tried to make it as easy to understand as possible. But social media is no place for eight-year-olds.
The name of the book is How Not to Mess Up Online. It's a follow-up to Selfies, Sects and Smartphones. I've been in conversation with digital law expert Emma Sadler. Emma, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
On to property now, and from vacant office blocks to vertical urban villages, Cape Town's inner city is slowly being reimagined. Mixed-use developments are transforming the CBD into a vibrant, walkable, live-work-play ecosystem that's reflecting global trends like the 15-minute city. According to the latest State of Cape Town Central City report, over 1.75 billion rand invested in mixed-use projects in 2023 alone. So let's discuss this in a little more detail, what it means for the city's economic future, the investment appetite and the urban experience. And I'm in conversation with Grant Elliott, Chief Operating Officer of Tebalt Investments, Deputy Chairperson of the Cape Town Central City Improvement District. Grant, welcome, and let's start with the big picture. What's driving the rise of mixed-use development in the CBD, and why now, I wonder?
Hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having us on the show. Look, there's a number of factors, I think, that are driving mixed-use development at the moment, in particular in the CBD. And I think, firstly, it really is around the city of Cape Town and infrastructural development that they are putting into the city. They're spending an enormous amount of money, and the reality is, without infrastructural development, the capacity, other property development is actually not possible. And I think, secondly, then, really their front-of-mind drive around economic development itself and a push towards tourism and keeping Cape Town as the number one tourist destination on the continent is really assisting property developers in making the choices to turn parts of their buildings into mixed use or certainly into residential. And I think you've also got to wind the clock back to 2018. You had landlords with large office vacancies in their portfolios. The fundamentals weren't great. And then we know what happened in 2019 and 2020 when the pandemic hit, and that made situation even worse. So we've actually now started to see landlords and developers converting their existing office stock into residential conversions, which is happening quite a lot over the CBD right now.
So, Grant, mixed use sounds great on paper, but I imagine getting the mix right is a little more tricky. What are the key ingredients for successful integration within a precinct?
You really do have to get your ratios right between the different uses. And the reason for that is that the different uses have different impacts on various portions of your buildings, like traffic times and congestion. You're also looking at different usage patterns on your lifts and your elevators and your air conditioning and your electrical systems. And another fundamental is that your office dweller and your leisure traveler don't normally mix very well in the same environment. So you have to really manage those aspects quite carefully. You've got to design them well. You've got to manage them well and make sure that everybody is appeased, because everybody has different needs within that same development.
So how do you do that? How do you get that balance right?
Look, we were quite lucky, and I'll give you an example of one Tybalt, which is a conversion that we did starting in 2021. We turned the top half of the building, which is a 29-story building, into residential apartments. And we kept the lower half of the building as office floors. And then we've got a bit of retail as well. And we were fortunate in that we have both high-rise and low-rise lifts, so we were able to actually separate our lobbies so that we have a dedicated office lobby and we have a dedicated residential lobby. So that made the situation quite good for us. And there are many buildings where developers are looking to convert, but they actually can't do it physically. Mm.
I mentioned at the start of our conversation this concept called the 15-minute city model, which I understand is central to the approach in Cape Town right now. So what is it? How is the city adapting to the concept? And why is it so powerful for urban planning these days?
The 15-minute city is really a theory that you can live and work and play within 15 minutes walk or ride on a bicycle of anything that you need to survive as a human being. And I think You know, Cape Town actually has all those ingredients already as a central business district. I think that what's key is really going to be how traffic is managed within the city. The pedestrianisation is already there, and I think that there's probably an opportunity to have more pedestrianisation in the CBD of Cape Town, and that encourages movement between the different precincts. Yeah, Cape Town really has most of the ingredients already at play and a very well-managed city, and I think that you've also got to go back to the early 2000s when the Central City Improvement District was started. They play a key role in making sure that the city is safe and clean on the ground. To give you some examples, there are over 100 security officers that patrol the streets at any one point in time. There's 65 cleaners that are on the ground, 16 law enforcement officers that are contracted to us from the city of Cape Town. So it really is, you know, extra top-up services that are being put in place by the CCID to those that have been provided by the city itself.
And Grant, I would imagine there's a degree of risk when it comes to conversion. They're not cheap or simple, as you've explained to me. What are the main difficulties that developers face then, and what would make a building either suitable or unsuitable for repurposing?
It's a very good question. The one thing that really developers need to look out for is how you build in your plumbing infrastructure in a conversion and how you integrate that vertically within a high-rise development. It's probably a bit easier if you're doing a full conversion, but plumbing runs vertically from top to bottom in one straight line. It's very difficult to change its path. So that's definitely one of the pitfalls to look for. Funnily enough, maybe not funnily enough, conversions are actually sometimes more economically viable than new builds. You're looking at new buildings coming out of the ground at circa 30,000 rand a square meter in today's terms, where if you've got a building, you've owned it for some time, or you've bought it for a good price, you can convert it for much less, so your returns naturally will be much higher.
And just finally, obviously resilience is critical in the property market, which is always cyclical. Does diversification in usage in any way help hedge against economic downturn?
It definitely does. And you've seen it with property portfolios across the country and across the world over many years, where property owners have diversified their portfolios between the different sectors: office, industrial, retail, residential. And the nature of the property industry is exactly that. It's cyclical. And when one industry is experiencing a downturn with weaker fundamentals, the other will prop it up. So you do get a bit more of a smoothing effect and a bit more protection from mixed use, in my opinion, certainly.
Grant Elliott, thank you very much indeed. Chief Operating Officer at Tybalt Investments, Deputy Chairperson, Cape Town Central City Improvement District. Appreciate your time, and I've enjoyed talking to you. Thank you. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.